You got it now? Give it back. All right, cut it there. Cut the beeper. Just a moment. I'll take it on another call. I wonder if you gentlemen will continue a moment. I want to grab this here.
Skipping motion.
The earlier, Major Aho, you were talking about a mysterious cave in Egypt. And perhaps I heard you wrong, but as I recall, you said that the reason that they deduced that they must have had atomic power was that they were painting by bright lights. Was that the statement that you made?
The general context of this man's statement in this lecture, he covered all of the Far East and various finds, archaeological finds that have been made there, especially in recent years. And he mentioned this one specific item, and I happened to hear this lecture. He stated that they were amazed when they found these paintings within a dark cave, covering all of the surface area of the cave, overhead and all of the sides. Everything was painted, and it was a terrific job of painting. And the colors, everything indicated that there were no shadows, that there had been no shadows in the cave when the painting was done. They had to have brilliant light in there in order to do this job of painting. Then, as a result of that, they began to investigate further, and they dug into various areas of the cave floor, and in the immediate center of this cave, they dug and they found lead down underground. It had been buried, covered over down through the years. There was a lead foundation right in the center of the cave, a kind of a, I don't know the exact shape of it, except that it was lead. And they checked it with Geiger counters, and it was still radioactive.
Lead doesn't get radioactive.
I mean, the ground in that vicinity, right around this lead, was radioactive, according to his statement.
Well, all ground is radioactive. Everything is radioactive to some extent. But this is a beautiful example of the way that people will build up fantastic accounts and complicated theories, perhaps on the basis of some simple fact. Now, we know there are caves like this in France with wonderful paintings right out underground in complete darkness and beautifully colored, and they've only been seen properly. Now we have modern electric lighting. Mm-hmm. Yet we know that the people who made those caves had only primitive forms of lighting. They must have mixed their colors out in the open light, and for some mystical or magical reason, painted these caves down in by the light of perhaps oil lamps or flickering torches. And in fact, you can see the smoke marks that their torches made. There's no mystery about it, except why they bothered to do it.
Why would anyone paint in the dark?
Well, it's magic. It's part of their religion and part of their fertility rites and all the rest of it. But we know how they painted these things. The smoke of the torches is there, and the colors are beautiful. They could never have seen the colors properly with their torches. We can see them with electric light, but that doesn't mean to say that they had electric light.
All I know about this is exactly what I heard, and this man was with an archaeological survey group that had been working in the Far East for approximately 30 years, and he made the statement. I have nothing to verify it or support it. All I know is that he made the statement. And if they did check this area with Geiger counters, it was radioactive only in the center of the cave.
And more than a normal Earth would do.
Oh, yes, highly radioactive.
Well, one would have to have an examination by competent scientists with proper equipment. And incidentally, one can think of a lot of ways in which this could easily happen naturally. For instance, assuming that there was an extra high layer of radioactivity, this often does happen. For instance, you may have particular salts going through particular stalactites. Which is the one on the top? I can never remember if it's a stalactite or the stalagmite.
The stalactite is on the top, I think.
Right. You have various deposits of minerals, and some of them accumulate in some areas, and you have radioactivity naturally concentrating.
Why would they have lead in the center of the cave? A lead foundation or a lead container, the way he described it, was like something had been in this lead container, but it was buried under the floor of the cave. Now,
well, frankly,
why was the lead there?
Frankly, I just do not believe this story. I mean, this is the kind of story you're always getting from out of the way places. Yeah. When you check up on them, the whole thing collapses. And there's a type of mind that likes to build up mystery about these things, and none of these cases ever substantiated. They all eventually evaporate, and people forget about them until the next mystery comes along, and then that evaporates.
I remember this this gentleman's name. It's been quite a while ago, and I just recalled his name. His name is J. O. Kinnaman. Kinnaman, and lecturing under the auspices of some group that had paid for a lecture tour that covered all of the state of California at this particular time. But I'm sure that this can be discovered as to whether there's any foundation or not. But he was telling about all of the archaeological finds in the ruins that have been uncovered, that I have seen published photographs of these, and he had with him many of the published photographs in the books of these various finds.
There's some wonderful ruins in South America. We know very little about the people who made them. But there are all sorts of theories that the age of these, some explorers claim that they're thousands, tens of thousands, millions of years old. But then the professional archaeologists go along and examine them, and they have no difficulty in refuting all these.
These were professional archaeologists. This man was with a professional group. And the books were published by this professional group, photographs, everything. And they had been doing that work for 30 years in Egypt and in the Far East, around the Eastern Mediterranean area. They were the group that had been doing this for 30 years.
Right.
And they were professional archaeologists.
Major, may I get in here to avoid what may be a confusion? Was the statement in this book published by the group of professional archaeologists that they had found evidences of a prehistoric race that used atomic energy, or was this just a sort of offhand lecture thing?
This was a statement this man made.
This was not in this book.
I didn't read the books to verify whether it was in the book or not.
I would take a bet that if the report has been published by some competent scientific organization, you will find none of this in it. This may be a speculation based on some report that is made. But if a thing like this is discovered by any archaeological organization, this would be headline news. This kind of thing doesn't remain spoken obscurely in some out-of-the-way lecture. This hits the headlines of the world, and it's because these things are never proved that they're all nonsense.
Well, I tend to disagree because... and the reason I disagree is because the history of mankind has been such that every new thing was obscure. The Wright brothers' plane, the news reporter that went over to cover the Wright brothers' plane story, couldn't even get the story published in his own newspaper. Why? Because it was contradictory to what the general belief of the time was. And engineers and scientists said that it was impossible for a heavier-than-aircraft to fly. And they stood on their scientific facts, and still the planes are flying right today. But anything new that is contradictory to the general trend of thinking or thought, it's just almost impossible for it to come out and assert itself if it is in contradiction to what the general belief.
This is a complete misunderstanding. This is not true. If a new thing comes out, there's often resistance to it. But in a very short time, never under any circumstances, more than a few years, if anything new and important, which is true, comes out, it is very quickly accepted, and after a while there is no further controversy around the matter. The best proof of the non-existence of spaceships from other planets is the fact that we are still arguing about it years after they're supposed to have landed. If they really were there, for example, this would have been settled completely without any shadow of doubt, just as there was no doubt that the Wright brothers flew after a year or so.
I think it'll be completely settled within a short time. I don't think there'll be any doubt, except in the minds of what I like to call hardheads. There's nothing wrong with being a skeptic. Every person is skeptical about
anything. That's not true. No, the trouble is that there are thousands of people who are not skeptical, and that's the trouble with this whole flying saucer business. There are thousands of people who are not skeptical enough.
Well, the non-skeptics, I feel, will be convinced. If there is reality in there, and I believe there is, they will be convinced, and I think within a reasonable time.
I agree with you completely.
But I think there will be some hardheads that will not be convinced, even if one hits them on the head.
No sane person doubts evidence when it's conclusive and before their own eyes.
Should we put those people that don't believe them in a...
That isn't quite right. Certainly, if a flying saucer lands in New York, then anyone who doesn't believe in its existence should be in a mental asylum. But at the moment, I think that most of the people who do believe in them should be in mental asylums.
Well, Mr. Priestley, fought the adoption, or I should say the abrogation of the phlogiston theory by Lavoisier for years. In fact, at the time of his death by George, he still wasn't going to admit that it was right.
This often happens with individual scientists. The Goethe, for instance, stuck to a crazy theory of color vision until the day of his death. Newton fought against the wave theory of light. He never believed in the wave theory of light and held that back for nearly 100 years. But things nowadays happen much more quickly than this. And if there's any important new discovery, it's either very quickly completely verified or completely refuted.
Actually, I don't think there is a great disparity of approach to these things between any of us. I personally wouldn't want to accept anything just on somebody's say-so, because there can be misinterpretation, personal misinterpretation. However, Mr. Clark, I could not go along with you in some statement you made earlier that the fact that contacts were reported in large numbers was a disproval. After all, this is an interpretation, again, of yours, because the larger number of reportings should indicate the more veracity to a situation. And again, a little later on, you said that when car lights were dimmed and cars stalled, somebody had nervous feet. Well, after all, four of these, 7 or 8 or 9 people involved were police officers, and they were not in the same car. Now, I think it's a little bit too much to expect that all of these men would be afflicted the same way, unless they saw something that had a lot more to it than just a mental mirage, shall we say. Another thing that you said was that Atlantis was disproven by borings. Well, I believe I asked you there if they bored all the Atlantic, which obviously they hadn't been able to at this time. So there would seem to me, although you made a very definite statement that Atlantis had been disproven, that there still would be a possibility that Atlantis might have existed.
Cortland, on this subject, you started to bring this up before. How large was Atlantis supposed to be?
Charles, I haven't any idea.
Well, I wondered. You seem to believe in it.
I think there's a good possibility, yes. I really do.
The point is this. One does not have to bore every square inch of the Atlantic to disprove the existence of a large continent, which what Atlantis is considered to be. You just sort of take it every 100 miles and you're okay.
Yeah, but
we have maps of the deposits, which are fairly accurate. The borings are only in a few places, but we have maps of these enormous areas of deposit, this ooze, which covers most of the bed of the Atlantic.
In other words...
It's thousands of feet thick. It's taken millions of years to accumulate.
In other words, you are satisfied that the borings to date have been sufficient to really have covered sufficient area.
But this is very striking evidence. It's not conclusive, and you have to sort of dig up the whole of the Atlantic. But if you have these gigantic layers of deposit, which do cover millions of square miles of the Atlantic bed, we have taken borings in several areas, and we find that in those areas it's taken millions of years for that ooze to build up. And this can be worked out quite accurate, like tree rings, like, you know, you can tell the age of a tree. There's little doubt about it.
Yeah, I haven't any vested interest in Atlantis, very obviously. But it's a possibility, no real estate, thank goodness.
I'd like to interrupt for a moment to remind our listeners that reports from Cape Canaveral, Florida, say there is an increased activity around the Navy Vanguard rocket project. Now, indicating that a firing of America's second satellite into space may be imminent. Mutual reporter Dick Bate is standing by at the test site just in case a test comes tonight so that he can give us a first-hand report. So we'd like to suggest to you to stay tuned to WOR.
Well, here we go back with good old Atlantis. And as a matter of fact, off of Atlantis, from what I will have to support Mr. Clark's contention about the thousands of cases of contact disproving it, where we're talking about two different things here. There had been thousands of well-authenticated cases of people seeing the flying saucers or contacting them. This begins to mount up into evidence. Obviously, the more people who see them, the more likely it is that they are there. But when you have thousands of disputed things, that is the point, I think, I'm talking for you here, Arthur, and you're perfectly capable. I think this is your point. When you have thousands of disputed contacts, when nothing has been proven after thousands of things, then you begin to wonder what's going on there.
The explanation must lie somewhere else.
Would you agree with these two psychiatrists in Kearney, Nebraska, for instance, that when the story of Reinhold Schmidt was added to some of the others, along with the Richard Kehoe report of a landing contact near Long Beach, California, that was reported to have involved three stalled automobiles. These young fellows all were going to work in the morning, and three cars stalled, one right behind the other. They claimed that spaceship was observed on the beach and that they spoke with two men that came from the ship. But in the Kearney incident, these two psychiatrists used this as a basis for their conclusion, stated in the nationwide press.
He was insane.
No, they didn't say that he was insane.
Oh, I'm on the wrong track here.
No, they said that Reinhold Schmidt told his story the same way each time. Therefore, he has a fixation, and he has to have immediate mental treatment. And they sent him to the hospital very, very rapidly. According to Reinhold Schmidt's report by letter and by tape recording, he says he demanded every test they possibly had. He didn't have any counsel. He had no jury trial. He had no kind of trial to determine whether he was mentally able or mentally ill or what. And he demanded, according to his own words, every test they could possibly give him. And he passed every test. Then what about the psychiatrist's first report or statement that due to the fact that he told his story, this was the basis for their conclusion, that he told his story the same way each time. Should a man who reports a sighting of a spaceship or a contact tell his story differently each time so that the psychiatrist won't attack him?
Uh-huh. I think there's a circular reasoning on the part of the psychiatrist. But my point is this. If these things are happening, and the Air Force is investigating them all, if there was any doubt, if they really had happened, all these reports, if something was ready there, do you think there'd be any doubt about it by now? There's these teams of investigators, official investigators, going around at government expense. Are you suggesting that they are lying to the public?
I think there's a great difference in whether one of those investigators is in the active military service or out of the service. We have the case of Captain Ruppelt, who was the Air Force investigator. And I have before me a document from NICAP in Washington, D.C., this worldwide organization that has been reporting this for quite a considerable time. And a statement in here by Major Kehoe, some of the items that he was not allowed to bring into that Armstrong Circle program. These are three or four items that that indicate that there is definitely something going on, even within the active service.
To me, there are so many which are of these sightings, Mr. Clark, which are reported by very long-term airline pilots, by radar operators, by ground observer corps people. There's a list here, I guess, there must be 100 names there, of which Dr. H. Percy Wilkins, one of your countrymen.
Now, wait a minute. Can I correct that? I don't think H.P. Wilkins has seen any. It's an H.T. Wilkins.
Well, it says H. Percy Wilkins, noted British astronomer, world-famous lunar expert.
Yes, well, he's been confused on H.T. Wilkins, who lives in the same area, and it's been very embarrassing to Mr. Dr. H. Percy Wilkins.
Before we get into the discussion, I want to take care of a little business.
They've just organized recently. Mr. Lester was kind enough to tell me something about it. And if you'd like further information, in other words, so many people write me letters, they'd like to know where they can sit around and talk with other people about saucers, how they can get into groups that are investigating saucers. Well, this is your opportunity. If you'd like information, just drop a card to NYSIB. NYSIB. Post Office Box 26. New York 24, New York. And I'm not kidding you when I say to you, that's the Planetarium Station. Square count. That's legit. That's no gag. Just remember, NYSIB, Post Office Box 26, New York 24, New York. Planetarium Station. Now, I don't know. Maybe they meet there or something. I don't know. Maybe it's an ideal place. I know many years ago I lived at that Hotel Colonial over there. And there's quite a lot of space here right near Central Park.
And who knows? Maybe they
can land a saucer there.
I guess they will.
He explains what happened on the Armstrong Circle Theater. Is that right, sir?
That's right. That's right, John. This letter is just recently came out of NICAP headquarters, and it's general information that was sent out to various persons that made inquiry to find out what happened. There were radio stations all across the country were flooded with mail and phone mm-hmm. calls asking why he was cut off of the air, and they wanted to know.
You mean television stations?
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. radio stations.
Radio stations too.
Why,
that's true, yes, they're news departments. While you're looking for the copy of that letter there, I notice you're trying to find it there. Okay. Let me just remind the people of the party line that this is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and this is Long John with the party line. We're around from midnight to 5:30, six mornings during the week. And Major Aho will have that letter in a moment, and he'll read it to us. And while we're waiting, let me tell you about this wonderful offer.
Yes, I'll be very happy to, John. I think that... it isn't a very long letter. I'll go ahead and read this whole item. It's dated January 28, 1958. Dear friend, please accept my apologies for this form letter made necessary by hundreds of queries about the Armstrong Theater UFO program. The statement I began when cut off the air was as follows. In the last 6 months, we, NICAP, have been working with a summit committee investigating official secrecy on unidentified flying objects. If open hearings are held, I feel it will prove beyond doubt that the flying saucers are real, and we urge citizens to write the committee in Washington, D.C. This statement was discussed with a sponsor's representative, and he agreed it would get wide attention, but later the producer told me that since he personally was not informed, he had no choice under CBS rules but to cut me off. However, even though this action was not deliberate censorship by CBS, strong Air Force pressure previously had caused deletion of a vital statement from my script. This script contained a statement listing four Air Force documents, never officially released, but which had been confirmed by the former chief of the Air Force Project Blue Book, Captain E. J. Ruppelt, and by another former project officer. The documents were, 1, a September 23, 1947, secret conclusion by Aerotechnical Intelligence Center that the flying saucers were real. 2, a 1948 top secret ATIC document concluding that the UFOs were interplanetary spaceships. 3, a secret Air Force intelligence analysis of UFO maneuvers, also concluding that the objects were interplanetary. 4, a secret report by a panel of top scientists convened at the Pentagon in January 1953, which urged A, that the Air Force quadruple its UFO project, and B, that they give the American people all UFO information, including secret Air Force conclusions, unsolved sightings, and photo analysis. These recommendations were officially rejected. According to one of the project staff, when my script was shown to the Air Force representative, he warned that the Air Force would immediately deny the document's existence if I were permitted to make the statement. This would also include denouncing the quoted source, their own former project chief, even though his book containing these items had been cleared by Air Force security and review. This Air Force threat, which appears to be censorship by intimidation, caused my planned statement to be cut off. In addition, though the program officials tried to present an impartial program, the Air Force insistence on an unfair share of the time forced me to delete many factual items refuting most Air Force claims. Among these were listing of official orders which silence armed forces personnel, citing of an Air Force letter to NICAP by Major General Joe Kelly, Director, Legislative Liaison, U.S. Air Force, refusing to release UFO reports and admitting they are classified for official use only. In case you wish to join us and help to make all the facts public, We are enclosing information on NICAP. Regardless, we appreciate your interest and your protest against secrecy on this vital subject. Signed, Major Donald Kehoe.
I think you might be interested, Major, in hearing a postscript that is on a letter that I just received this week from Kenneth Arnold. I am not reading the entire letter. I'm waiting a couple of days because this is kind of exciting and maybe something more to it. However, the postscript is this. It might be of interest to you to know that one of our major airlines advised their pilots who had encountered in their flights unidentified flying objects not to appear on a program with Mr. Donald Kehoe. I don't mean to be evasive in not giving you the names of and the airline, but would you be, but if you so desired as private information, but would, if you so desired as private information, I'm sorry. However, I'm not going to ask him for the names or anything like that, but it's an interesting piece. I've received some information from Mr. Arnold, and we might at some times use it on the air. At the present moment, I have no intention to. I have a lot of other material that should prove of great interest to our listeners as well. Major Ahole, you also, I think, mentioned that you had some additional information about Mr. Schmidt, the gentleman who claims that a flying saucer landed near him when he was out in Kearney, Nebraska.
That's correct, John.
Could you tell us about that, please?
Yes, John. Might I digress for just a moment on this Kenneth Arnold situation? I was listening to your program down at Washington, D.C., when Kenneth Arnold appeared immediately after the Armstrong Circle Theater and explained on a telephone interview why he did not appear on that Armstrong Circle Theater program. And if I understand correctly, why his objection was that some real factual information was not being presented, that he knew of much better information or additional information that should have been in this program. Do I understand that correctly, that that was his reason for
that? That was about it, as I recall the conversation, that he felt there were things that were being suppressed, that there were a full view of the facts was not being given.
Yes. Well, that's what I thought. Now on this this Reinhold Schmidt story, for anyone who isn't familiar with the story from the beginning, in that November, what many people now call FLAP, any great activity that occurs at a certain place or at a certain time in any state or area is called a FLAP. But in the November FLAP, an incident was reported by from Kearney, Nebraska, and it got on a nationwide radio program, and I believe it was also on television, where this Reinhold Schmidt stated that he had been driving his car near Kearney, and he had spotted an object in a riverbed, the Platte riverbed, a dry channel. And he drove toward this object thinking that it was a balloon that had somehow crashed or landed on the ground. When he was near, when he approached the object, his car stalled. And he got out of his car and walked toward this object. And various things happened then where he claims that he was searched for weapons, that two men came from this ship and searched him for weapons. And
This is something new to me. I thought that they were pretty friendly on the way.
Oh, yes. He said they were friendly, but the first thing that happened, he said they turned some kind of a ray or something on him that held him motionless. He was paralyzed. He couldn't move. And immediately after that, these two men came and asked him if he were armed. Mm-hmm. And he said he carried no weapons, but they searched him. And then he was invited to go aboard the ship. But he stated that these persons were appeared friendly at all times, that there was no threats or anything like that. And they invited him to come aboard the ship until they were ready to depart, claiming that they were making some repairs.
Mm-hmm.
He asked them where they were from, but they did not say. They said they made a statement according to his presentation of this that tell your people that we mean them no harm, and also they added that soon your people will know what this is all about. And he was aboard this ship apparently for about 20 or 25 minutes. He has stated in correspondence that he hopes to come to Washington, D.C. and tell his story and clear his name from the claim or the indication that he was mentally ill, because the public has never been straightened out on what finally happened. The last many people know was that he had been sent to the state mental hospital. And he hopes also to come to the New York area, perhaps, that he can get up here and appear on the program.
Well, Major Aho, there's one point in there that, unless I'm confusing the stories that you've left out, which seemed to me one of the most interesting facts. Wasn't this the case where the man said that the saucer inhabitants spoke high German?
Yes, he said they spoke to him in broken English.
Mm-hmm.
He could understand them. But when they spoke with each other, they spoke what sounded to him like a high German. Now, whether he speaks German himself, I don't know yet for certain. His name indicates that he is perhaps of German ancestry.
Well, this was...
perhaps he understands German, but he made that statement.
This is the point I haven't had cleared up, because I have heard both stories that, not from him, understand, but secondhand reports that he just barely recognized the language as High German, and yet another report that he, in fact, understood it perfectly because he was second-generation American, and
yes,
his parents spoke German or something.
I am hoping to, while I'm in the Midwest area, if I can possibly do it, I want to interview him and question him about many of those fine points and find out exactly what he observed, cover the whole story, including the hospital experience and everything that happened, in order to have a complete picture of this. But immediately after this, when this he reported that when this craft was ready to leave, they told him that he would have to leave the ship, but they told him not to try to start his car, that it would not start yet until they had left.
Mm-hmm.
So he left the ship, and he turned to look, and he said it left in with a terrific speed, which again ties in with that the reported landing from Long Beach, California. This Richard Kehoe tells down there that when he observed this big craft that was on the beach, when it departed, they said it was left with a whoosh. It was like two automobiles passing each other at high speed. So then he got in his car, and I have heard reports. I haven't had definitely had a chance to confirm this from Mr. Schmidt, but I have heard a report that he went to see a minister first, and he was very startled and shocked by this incident. And he went to see a minister first, and then he went to see the sheriff to report the incident. In his tape recorded interview that I have a copy of, he states that he asked the authorities there to rope off this area to guard it so that all evidence, all signs would be left there. And he claims that he was told by the sheriff that it was not necessary to do this, that they had three or four other witnesses, and that there was no question of whether the ship was there or not, that no further evidence was needed. And the information was given by a letter that I received from a person in Kearney that was investigating this situation, that the authority there, the sheriff or the local chief of police, made a statement which was recorded, that they agreed with this man's story, that they found tracks and evidence that corroborated his original statement, and they supported his story. Also, the chief of police from Bakersfield, California, supported the man and his basic honesty and integrity. Many things happened fast. The Air Force intelligence and apparently the FBI arrived on the scene, and A great deal of questioning took place. I have a letter which states that he was questioned for 23 hours in a row, and then after a few, 2 or 3 hours of rest, he was questioned for about 18 hours more. I haven't verified this definitely with Mr. Schmidt, but I think that we'll know in time exactly what happened there. Then, too, from this letter I have from Carney, I have a statement that two psychiatrists, and I have the names of the psychiatrists, that arrived from the state mental hospital, and in questioning Mr. Schmidt, then the situation developed where they said that he told his story the same way each time, and they suspected him of having a fixation. And his is in his tape-recorded interview that I have a copy of, he states that upon arrival at the hospital, they asked the doctors asked him what he was there for, and he said, "It wasn't my idea to come here." Says, "But being as I'm here, I insist that you give me every test possible to check on my sanity." And he states that this was done, and he spent a total of 2 weeks there, and then was released with a clean bill of health. The situation develops that he's working again as a grain buyer, as he was doing before this happened, and working for a firm from Raleigh, California, known as the Value Pack Company, and he's right back in Kearney, Nebraska. He states that the he's trying to find the other witnesses that were involved, but there are several prominent people who have stated that there are witnesses present. But he says that these witnesses so far have been afraid to come forth for fear that the same thing will happen to them that happened to him.
You mean that they'll be taken to the sanitarium?
Taken to the sanitarium.
So what did the other other witnesses, were they supposed to have seen all this from a distance? Him going into the saucer, or just the saucer, or what? Does he?
I'm not certain what the other witnesses saw. I'm under the impression that they saw a ship either descending or taking on. And that they didn't necessarily witness the...
They weren't close enough to see him being searched or going in or coming out or anything.
And exactly what will develop from that score, I'm not certain yet. But he, in his letters to me, he has indicated that his attorneys are not interested now in whether his story is believed or not, that they want justice in this case, and they want the man's name cleared, and they are suing apparently for damages.
Who are they suing?
I'm not sure whether it's the city of Kearney or whether it's these individuals that participated in this or who it is. That's something that I don't know yet, as who is who the complaint is drawn up against. I have another interesting item that arrived in a letter just night before last, which is also of great interest. This letter is dated January the 30th. Dear Major Aho,
this is from Mr. Schmidt?
This is from Mr. Schmidt.
Mm-hmm.
And he states... states here that he's willing to come to Washington, D.C. or any place to try to prove his point, and that he is willing to pay even to the part of the expenses involved to try to clear
How would he prove his point in Washington? This I don't understand.
Well, I think that what he's... immediately after he arrived back in Kearney, he was hopeful that he would get back on a national program to show that he was out of the hospital and that he still insisted on...
That he could talk rationally and so forth, that he wasn't babbling and
that's
this
right.
and the other.
And that he still maintained the same situation, that he claimed that he had been aboard the ship and that everything that he had said was substantially true.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not able to get on such a nationwide program. It was in the developing, but then it was suddenly canceled. So he apparently is interested in getting around the country and getting the word around that he is there and he is not in the hospital. Also, he made a statement here that he'll come if there's anything at all done or if anything is arranged, why he'll be very happy to go and try to clear his name. But he further states in this letter that, this is of great interest because it mentions something about the Air Force. He says, the Air Force has written me several letters. They are now quite interested. Got a letter this morning from the Air Force at San Francisco, California. And then he gives the address here, which I'm not going to mention over the air because he doesn't want to make this public because there are apparently some cooperation going on.
Let me slip a point in here. When you mentioned earlier that he'd been questioned for 23 hours and then 18 hours, was that by the local police or did the Air Force take any part in that?
I don't know. I don't know the facts on that. That's one thing that I wanted to find out.
Yeah.
But this was mentioned in the letter that I received from some parties in Kearney that were investigating to find out exactly what happened. But he goes on to quote from this Air Force letter. He says, the director wishes you success in your lawsuit against the idiotic individuals concerned. Thank you very much for the assistance you have rendered. And then the signature and the address of the party.
This was a letter from the Air Force?
This was a letter from the Air Force.
Ooh, wow, that's strong language for an Air Force letter.
Well,
I don't doubt it, but
no,
it's not very strong language.
I have this quote from him, but apparently I did notice in the news release that went nationwide, there was a little section right at the bottom that said that the federal authorities, I didn't mention who the authorities were, that the federal authorities were opposed to this type of action, meaning sending him to the mental hospital for examinations and so forth, for fear that others who had incidents, had experiences, would refuse to report their information to the government. And it might be that that the Air Force had something to do with that. But this letter, and he will, if this is true, he will have a copy of this letter, an official copy of
it.
He will. And there's pretty strong language there to indicate that these parties that wrote to him are not, thought that some of this was a very idiotic handling of this situation.
Well, let me take a moment to talk about one of our sponsors. I think you mentioned sometime this morning about a man by the name of Richard Kehoe. Is that a relative of Major Kehoe?
No. Richard Kehoe states in a tape-recorded interview that he is not any relation to Major Donald Kehoe, and Major Donald Kehoe has come up with a statement to that same effect. There's a very interesting study here. Here we have Major Donald Kehoe in Washington, D.C., the director of NICAP, a worldwide organization, and over in Long Beach, California, in the far side of the country, a Richard Kehoe.
Richard. Does he spell it the same way?
Same spelling. A Richard Kehoe, who states in the tape-recorded interview that I have a copy of with me here, that he did not believe in flying saucers, and that he had seen Major Kehoe's book in the bookstand, but he never bothered to buy it because he just didn't go for this situation. And here on November the 6th, 1957, at about 5:40 a.m., he reports that he was driving to work in the Long Beach area there, and his car stalled suddenly when he was driving down the highway, and his lights went out. And he pulled over to the side of the road, and two cars following him says the same thing happened to them. They says their lights went out, and they pulled up behind him. And the amazing thing is that these fellows say that after they got out of their cars and they looked around to see what was going on, they saw a large ship parked along the beach that had was landed right about 20 or 30 feet from the water's edge on the Long Beach there, and that this, he describes the size of this ship as being about 50 feet high and 150 to 200 feet long, and he said that it had a blue haze surrounding the entire ship.
That's a hard one to say. Was this a saucer-shaped ship?
It was more of a cigar-shaped or an egg-shaped object, the way he described it. This word flying saucer has become so distorted now that usually when you say flying saucer, they're talking about
You look for something somewhere. Sure.
Anything that that flies through the air that seems to be some kind of a controlled craft or is on the ground, whether it's square or round or saucer-shaped, disc-shaped.
Or a saucer-shaped ship.
Or anything.
I like that phrase.
So, anyway, they got out of their cars, and they were observing this ship on the beach. And this Richard Kehoe was later interviewed by Paul Coates, a radio announcer in that area. And in the line of question that that developed by Richard Kehoe indicated exactly what he felt about this whole situation. He was questioned as to whether this ship that they saw on the sand could have been actually an object in the water, some kind of a floating ship that they just misunderstood or mistook it or thought it was on the beach when it was actually in the water. And he said that they all agreed and they were all aware that there was nothing in the water and anywhere within sight at that time. There's no craft in the water with any lights or anything, and that the only object was this ship on the beach. But the next amazing thing was the two men approached them from the beach, and they came up a little stairway up to the highway where these fellows' cars had stalled, and these fellows were standing there, and apparently from the tape recorded interview, why, their chins were hanging down. They were all just absolutely dumbfounded and speechless. And he described these two men that approached them as being about 5'6" or 5'7". About 135 to 140 pounds. He described the clothes they wore, that they had tight-fitting trousers that were apparently black or dark in color. This was about 5:30 in the morning, so it was quite early. This happened when they were driving to work. And he gave the names of the other two fellows involved. He gave their names as they were given to him as being Joe Thomas of Torrance, California, and Ronald Burke of Redondo Beach, California. And he described these fellows and their appearance in a lengthy discussion. He said that they had a very perfectly formed face, that it was the most perfect features that he had seen. That their nose, their chin, everything seemed to be just absolutely perfection, and that their skin was of a different tint or different hue than what ours is. But at first, I noticed that something that was very interesting here was that he practically insisted that these were Earth people, that they couldn't have been space people because they looked so much like us. But then he proceeded to show them. Bring out various things that he had noticed that would make them definitely different from Earth people. But his insistence was very interesting, that he first felt that they definitely had to be Earth people. But he later brought out the fact that their ears came to more of a point up at the top, and that their uniform, the clothes they wore, was somewhat different from what we wear, except that it looked a little bit like a motorcycle driver's uniform or outfit, especially because of the trousers, and that they had a large what looked like a large belt with a with some kind of a carving or some kind of inscription over on the side. And they wore shoes that had no laces, but they looked to either be leather or plastic. You couldn't tell in that light.
Well, I've got shoes with no laces on right now. I don't know why that should impress him.
Well, he just commented about that in noticing various things about them. And he said that they didn't wear anything on their head, but their hair was cut fairly short. That they it was like a college crew cut almost. And their hair was about 3 inches long, you might say, in the longest point.
Mm-hmm.
And it was...
You should insist so that these were Earth people, while at the same time pointing out all the things that.
Yes, I thought it was very interesting. Then he said that the color of the skin, that they seemed to have a kind of yellowish or greenish tint to the skin.
And he still said they were Earth people?
He still said they were Earth people. And I think that the interviewer probably noticed that right away, and also the people that interviewed him later. But he was so struck by this whole thing, it may be that he has never considered the possibility that these might come from space. Also, the when he mentions the interview that took place, these fellows spoke to them. He said that they spoke to him in a broken English. They spoke to all three of them, mm-hmm. and they all witnessed this situation. That they spoke in broken English, or what seemed like a foreigner would speak American that was not familiar with the language, but he said they didn't have any trouble understanding them, that they clearly understood what they meant. The questions asked ran along this line, what time is it? What is the nearest city? What is the nearest city to where we are? And these fellows told them what city this was and so forth. And there was something mentioned or asked about where are they going, meaning the three drivers that were stalled there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them asked these two fellows where they were from, and they received no answer whatsoever. They didn't reply at all. And he was asked as to whether they seemed to be friendly or hostile or what, and he said they appeared to him to be very friendly. In describing their attitude, their behavior, they asked him just how did he feel about them, and he said, "Well, in appearance, it's as if I saw a perfect FBI man. It says these fellows would have been a perfect description of an FBI man, you might say, that they seem to be completely composed and have complete control of the
green
situation."
FBI man,
something.
A very strange way to describe an FBI man.
And he said that they, it says, if you if you were sitting in a poker game and if you had a perfect poker face that did not show any emotion or any sign of any excitement of anything, he says, these fellows had a perfect poker face. He says, they didn't bat an eye.
Hmm.
And when they left, he said that they turned on their heel. They didn't say goodbye. They didn't say anything. But he said he didn't have a feeling, that he personally didn't have a feeling as they were cutting off the interview and showing any kind of resentment that they were like well-trained troops, that when they left, they turned around and left without any hesitation. And they marched down the beach. They got into the ship. They saw a beam of light come out as they entered the ship in some opening, and he said immediately after, when they got aboard, he said the ship left with a whoosh. He said it's the most fantastic thing he ever saw. And it sounded like two cars passing each other at high speed on the highway, and that's all the noise there was, and boom, it was gone. And they asked him, well, how did he feel about it afterwards? He said, well, we walked slowly to our cars, and he says, you can describe a fellow who's just been cleaned out in a poker game. He says, that's how we felt. He says, we were just absolutely dumbfounded.
I'm a little dumbfounded at this point, too.
Yes.
But I'll have to do a little piece of business.
This is long gone.
Oh, you're on already. I can't stop it.
Long gone.
Long gone. Don't put me on the beat.
Oh, you're on already. I can't stop it.
Okay. I sent a letter to you about the zombies, you know, that, remember?
Yes.
I told you about the zombies.
I know.
You
yes.
told me to send it on care, for Dave Bell, care of you.
Yeah.
But I don't hear Dave Bell anymore.
Oh, you
did
you
get the letter?
Huh? I don't know. He hasn't told me it yet.
Oh. But I typed that off the article from Fate, you know,
yeah.
You remember?
Incidentally, we're going to have the editors of Fate magazine with us on Friday night. Saturday morning, yeah.
Could you ask Dave Bell to give you that? Then it would be...
I certainly will, as soon as I see Dave.
I typed it off at 40 pages.
Yeah. All right, then.
Okay, thank you
very
bye.
Much. Bye-bye.
Well, one of our nice listeners, and as I say, we'll have the people on from Fate magazine, the editors, and I think you better be tuned in. Even a couple of minutes before 12, because I understand we're going to start right out, and that's going to be so exciting. I've been told by William the Preston that we may even have them a second night. In other words, not two consecutive nights, but have them back again Tuesday. So be on early, early, everybody. Major.
You know, John, I've been observing Mr. Leadham here all evening, and after due consideration, I'm convinced now that he is a Venusian. He sat here all this night for almost 5.5 hours, and he shows absolutely no weariness whatsoever, and I'm convinced he's a Venusian.
Well, Major, you are mistaken, I'm sorry to say. It is not Venus. It is, in fact, the planet Jupiter. Yes?
That's the bigger planet.
This is why I happen to be the size I am, because I come from Jupiter. And you'll notice that I'm sitting in a special chair here. The actual truth is that I weigh 3,200 pounds. And if it weren't for the special construction of this chair, I splintered several the first time I was up here on the show, and John had to order this one for me. It's a very touchy situation. I don't generally like to talk about it on the air, but we Jovians do not sleep. We found it very handy that way.
You had to get much more time there to accomplish things.
We have more time to build saucers and think of the basic principles of the universe and to, try and exist on this lousy planet. And this is Jupiter, not Earth. Earth is a great place, but this lousy planet that we were born on, it's a real rough fight, kids, I tell you. It takes 47 hours a day. The Jovian day is 47 hours long.
I thought it was 46 and a half.
Well, that's in leap years, John.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Well, it's 9 minutes after five.
Earth time. You might want to announce this Earth time.
Earth time. Mm-hmm. Hi there, this is Long John. I see one of my good listeners just telling me that we're into February.
Good, right.
And I... What have I said? What have I been saying? I've been saying February.
I don't know what you've been saying.
February.
I've been listening.
And it should be what?
Well, you're not disputing this man's spelling because it's correct.
No. It's February.
Well, I think if you have February, no one gives the first R February.
Well, this nice person would like to have me try it this year.
Would like to have you try February? Well, if he says February, well, he's going to get some strange looks from people that he's talking to. I don't know.
I don't know. February.
February. Everyone says
February.
February. I'm sure that Winston Churchill says so do I, for that matter, if he ever happens
well,
to say it.
He hasn't even been
he
on the program.
Quiet throughout the month. I don't know, just to avoid this particular contretemps. But
that's a funny thing. You know, we've never been able to book him on the program.
I tell you what, I know a fellow in Philadelphia that looks so much like him that you'd be sure to get away with it.
See, I understand you were in Philadelphia with Major Kehoe a short time ago.
With Major Kehoe?
Yeah.
No, I lectured to the two groups in Philadelphia.
And you were not there with Major?
No.
Oh, no. I don't know. I heard someplace there. I think it was the day that they called me up about Schmidt.
Hi there, this is Long John. Yes. Hello.
Yes. Hello. 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 Well, I guess we have a call.
Hmm? No, I had a Martian on.
We did. What did he have to say for himself? Was he, or did he communicate?
He called himself Bronzot.
Oh, Bronzot. Well, that wasn't on the... I know about Bronzot. He's, he can't go home, you understand.
That's right.
But, I mean, on the telephone, you know.
No.
Calling up Dieter, like, saying that what this man just said about Mars is wrong because, you know, I know, Mac. Nothing like that.
No, but I had one time a gentleman called me two or three times, and he wanted to bring over, a Martian that they had captured.
Oh.
And they, well, first of all, we had to air the studio out for an hour beforehand, no smoking in the studio, and they wanted to bring in a special piece of equipment to cleanse the air. And they brought him in, and they wanted to know if we had AC current. They had a special garment for him, and they plug it into the AC current to keep him warm.
Too bad you didn't invite them over.
No, I didn't.
Interesting guest.
Yeah, certainly would. But I mean, on TV it would have been great. Hi there, this is Long John.
We look pretty good.
This is Long John.
Hello, Long John. How are you today?
We look pretty good. How are you?
Fine, thanks. You know, it'll...
Turn your radio down, Leo. Yes, Leo. Hello. Hello. Leo.
That's a very funny thing. Well, I'm sure that was Leo K. Handel. Sounded like him, didn't it? Russ? And I told him to turn down his radio, or turn it off, and he must have disconnected the phone. I don't know. That's right. Dobermans, and we got them. No, here, what's this? Dobermans can be gotten from Mrs. William B. Hill, West John Street, Hicksville, Long Island. Phone number is Wells 10151. And Mrs. Croes, Croes, of Broad, what, Bronx? Oh, Bronx. Yeah. Well, what is all this about?
I don't know. Somebody got confused. We don't want Doberman.
Hello?
We want miniature dachshund.
No, I didn't want to buy a Doberman.
I've got Doberman.
Oh, no, I guess, no. I'm sorry. Thank you, Ed.
No, this lady's very nice. She thought I wanted to buy a Doberman. No. I was looking for a miniature...
Dachshund. I've got Dobermans up to the eyeballs. We don't need any more of them.
No, I thought I would have one, but, I know there are places I can buy them. It's just a matter that I haven't had the time to get over there.
It takes, the trouble is that it takes a lot of time, as I, you'll pardon me if I get no plug for that magnificent volume, Obedience Training by Charles Medium. In the first chapter, talking about getting himself, as I said, it takes a long time, because one of the worst things you can do is go and look at one litter of puppies. Because there's nothing which will knock your sales resistance quite so hard as a litter of tumbling pups. And you've got to really get it up to the highest notch and go and look at 2 litters and 3 litters and 4 litters and 5 litters and take your take your pick out of that. And this takes a great deal of time, which is why it's difficult to get around and find a Mindocs like that.
Well, it's very nice of these people to call
up. Yeah, it was thoughtful of them. I'm sorry that they got the wrong breed, though. Miniature dachshunds we want, Dobermans we've got.
Yeah, well, now we know, though, that Mrs. William B. Hill... Is that the lady who called? Mrs. Hill? Oh. She lives on West John Street in Hicksville, Long Island. That was very nice, sir.
Yes?
I don't want Mrs. H. Peters of Andover, New Jersey. Well, what can I do?
What can I do?
Oh, they have miniature Dobermans over there. Oh, I see. Thank you.
Miniature Dobermans we want. Dachshund, that's what we want.
How big is a miniature Doberman?
Oh, he stands about...
What's the 7 pounds?
9-10 inches high.
7 pounds?
They're very tiny little kids. They're not miniature Dobermans. Miniature pinchers. You have to get that straight.
Well...
9-10 inches high, maybe, and they weigh very, practically nothing at all. They're very cute.
What
are
they
cost
about?
Well, it's hard to say. The average pup costs you about $150.
Let's talk about something else. Let's take a Hi there, this is Long John. What happened to you?
Long John.
Hello, John.
Say, what happened to you?
I don't know. I just went to turn that radio down a bit and just reached over to turn the dial, came back and got the dial tone.
Yeah.
I remember the last time I called, there was a sort of, tongue-in-cheek call, you know, from Ecuador. And, just as I was trying to tell you something, some kind of ambulance or something went by with a little sign.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And that was it. And I got a dial tone. It looks like somebody really sabotaging us.
I don't know what's happening.
Well, I don't know.
How's things going, Lil?
Oh, pretty fair. No complaints. I meant to drop in to visit you, you know, but then every time I want to come over, something else turns up and makes it impossible.
We've got a few letters here and all. I tell you what, I want you to... Wait a minute. You got some stuff on Leo K. Handel, haven't you? There? You know what you could do? You want to take my phone out of that line and plug it into the line with Leo, and when I get off the beeper, would you take his address so we can send it, huh? We got a couple of cards here for you, Leo. Leo, I don't know what they are or anything, but don't give me your address now. In other words, when we, when you and I are through talking, we're off the beep for the interview.
Listen.
Yes, Leo.
What I called up to say was that I'm very, very interested in the fact that there's a possibility that you might be on earlier in the evening, and I think it's about time that they recognize that people other than we who work all night would be interested in your type of program.
Well, Leo, the only problem is I think you realize that I cannot do a program like this in an hour, so the only way I could do it would be taking the best of the week or the best of 2 weeks ago and edit it down so that you'll get all the meat and no potatoes.
Well, naturally. I mean, there couldn't be any other method of programming it. You couldn't let people talk, you know, off the cuff and expect to get anything in an hour. Now, I know if I'm talking off the cuff without any preparation, I can talk for 4 hours, and you know, in 4.5 or 5 hours, I wind up saying nothing, you know. Imagine how little I'm saying in an hour.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's true to a lesser degree with most other people. So I suggest that you do sort of take the meat from, you know, some of these 5.5 hour programs, mainly some of the programs where Major Markov was on, I think would be very good.
Oh, yeah.
I think that would really start the ball rolling, and then you could follow through with some of those saucer stories. Howard Menger, I think, would be excellent.
Yeah.
Van Tassel and a few of the others in that field.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you could follow through with as a naturopath or an argument on hypnotism, you know, really taking the meat out of those discussions and putting them on an hour program. I think that would be terrific. I, for one, would make it a point to listen in, and I have friends, you you know, who can't stay up as late as I do. And when I tell them of the program and tell them what goes on, well, they stay up and listen to one or two programs, but then, you know, they got to go out and earn that bread, you know, in order to live. And so they can't, you know, spend that time. And they always say to me, gee, wouldn't it be great if you were on a little earlier? You know, we'd love to listen to that. In fact, we might even, you know, take a real interest, especially in Homer Boomer. In fact, there's a gigantic move here now in Newark to form a Homer B. Boomer society, you know, whose main purpose would be to propagate the name and fame of Homer B. Boomer, the rightful inventor of the boomerang.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of candidates, including members of the Newark Police Department, whose names I won't mention because these men are very interested in joining, you know. And they're all in favor of Homer B. Boomer.
Well, fine.
Well, if anything happens on that, I'll let you know. Thank you, Leo. And, Leo, wait a minute. Are you ready, Dave? All right. Put me on the beeper. Get off the tape. My radio's off. All right. So long. So long. So long. Yeah. And this is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and I think we're going to have to wrap it up for another morning. In another couple of minutes or so. I don't know what it is. I feel really worn out. I guess it's because I haven't been in bed for about 30 hours.
We were running around like mad lining up that phone call from Canaveral for about half an hour, which is enough to wear anybody out.
Say, John, I wondered, have you heard any new good interplanetary jokes on the interplanetary orbit lately? Has anything new come in on that interplanetary orbit?
No, no. Do you know something?
No, I've run out of jokes. I told the last ones I'd heard. I just wondered if you'd heard any new ones.
No, no. You know, from time to time in the mail, but I'm just catching up with some of the mail that I've had on hand, and we're trying to get it sorted out. We certainly appreciate the fact that the people on the party line are kind enough to send in the cards and letters. Sort of brings us up to date as to what they think about the program. And, well, who knows? Maybe we will, maybe we won't.
The only joke I can think of, you play bridge, don't you, John?
I haven't played bridge in years, and I forget. Now, is that what you use the cue stick with? Is that the game?
No, you use the mallet, you know, and you have the little hoops on the lawn.
Oh, yeah, I knew something like that.
The horrifying story, the other night, Betty and I had been thinking we'd brush up on our bridge, so we went over to some friend's house, and we were talking, and said, you people don't play bridge, do you? And they said, oh, well, we're not very good at it, but, you know, we play. And so we said, well, let's try a few rounds and see what happens. So we sat down at the table and got the cards out and got a score set and everything, all ready to play. And you may not believe this, but the guy says to me, I'm a little dim on it. How many cards do you deal to a person? So we folded up the table, folded up the cards, and went away. And that's my sad story for the night. Oh, man, that was too much. How many cards do a person? Ooh, how?
Major, do you see Major Kehoe often in Washington?
I do once in a while. However, our we're both so busy that it's just a madhouse all the time. I'm pounding the corridors up in Congress or traveling around the country. But I try to spend quite a bit of time up in Congress because I think it's quite important, and they're very much interested in getting more interested all the time on the Hill.
What do you think of the move to go out in the Mojave Desert with lots of cans of white paint and make a huge sign with letters about 3 miles high saying Martians go home? Did you go along with that?
No.
No? That would take a lot of the load off of you and Major Kehoe, that's for sure.
A funny bit, Charles. Very, very
good. We'll have to use it on the air sometime.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think it would have been great if we would have been on the air tonight. It was a night off, though.
Well, this way we're going to be, you know, all rehearsed for tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Or for tonight, or was it yesterday night? I get a little confused about this.
What is this? This is Saturday? Or?
I think this is the second Thursday in the week or something like that.
I think you're right.
Yeah. It gets confusing out here. This is either tomorrow night or yesterday morning. I'm not sure which right now.
Well, I can tell you one sure thing, that it's really been a pleasure talking with the people on the party line. And my name is Giff Campbell. I'm around from 12 to 5:30.
Rodney Dexter playing the part of Alan.
And I sincerely hope that many of the people on the party line will send a card or a letter to me, Gift Campbell. Send it to WOR. That's Harry Carlson, your Sunrise Serenader. He'll be along in just a couple of minutes.
Don't forget about him.
That's right. Neighbors, I think we'll have to wrap it up, and we should at least have 1 minute of silence and respect for the great Gift Campbell, the gentleman that has done more to keep radio where it is today.
40% better than ever before.
That's it. Thanks very much, Major Ahole, for joining us. We appreciate it a lot.
Thank you, John. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
And I know that the people listening to the program will certainly be happy to go over to the New York Center, where Major Ahole and Cortland Hastings will be giving a lecture on Thursday night. That's right. Russell Ticklepaw, engineer, and Al Nielsen, the old junk man. And we'll all be back with you again tonight at midnight. And I hope you'll be joining us. So if you're getting up, I sincerely hope you have a very, very pleasant day. And don't forget to stay tuned to Harry Carlson and John B. Gambling. Get a good night's sleep. And sleep real good. Bless you. Thank you.